Good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. I hope everyone's joining us either on the phone lines or for streaming audio for today's internet seminar on Pro-UCL. This is part two of our seminar series. This is the more advanced of the sessions, which is scheduled to run from 1 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and has been sponsored by the EPA's ORD Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center. My name is Jean Valance, and I will be helping to assist with the online delivery today, coming from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. We're going to give a couple of extra minutes to some latecomers to join us, but while we do that, I'm going to go over some housekeeping and instructions for others. When you registered for today's internet seminar, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage, which was a summary roll-up, which had complete logistic information for today, a description as well as an agenda for what we'll cover today. You'll find contact information for all of our instructors and presenters. And on that very same homepage, you'll also find options to either go to the seminar. If you click on that button on the left side of the screen, you can open up the slides in a web browser window. Or you can follow the links that appear at the bottom of that seminar homepage to download a copy of the presentation materials as either PowerPoint or PDF. So you want to be sure to do that now, because with all CLUIN Internet seminars, they're treated very similar to a conference call. Each individual participant will be expected to move through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. Just a reminder, if we don't have enough time to handle all of the questions that may come in today, again, you can find contact information for all of our speakers on that seminar homepage, and you'll be encouraged to go ahead and reach out and email them directly, but we'll remind you throughout the session of how you can follow up with questions that we may not have time to answer today. For those of you on the phone lines, I have globally muted all of the telephone lines, so we're not letting anybody other than the instructors talk for now. We will take two breaks for question and answer, and at that point we'll provide reminders or instructions on how you can take yourself off of mute to ask a question directly. But until then, we do ask that you simply sit back and hang tight. If you do need to hang up, please feel free to do so. There won't be any disruption. We would ask, though, that you don't put the call on hold. If you need to disconnect, go right ahead. You can dial right back in with no disruption to our call. Everyone, I'm going to ask if you could to move past slide number one and either turn the page or click to slide number two. Those of you that are looking at the slides online in the web browser window will notice that there are numbered links that appear on the left-hand side of each slide that you can use to navigate to the materials. You can also use the buttons that appear above the slides in orange circles. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. For those of you who are streaming audio online, or for those of you who are looking at the slides online, there's another button up top that you'll see that has a question mark button inside. If you click that and make sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up, and you can actually use that short form that appears to type up comments or questions and communicate to us. So if you're streaming audio and you want to submit a comment or question, you'll want to click on that question mark button to submit it to us electronically. And then at the appropriate break for questions and answers, again, we'll have two of those, one in the middle and then one at the end, I will actually read those questions out loud to the speakers so that they can answer them directly to you. You don't have to wait until the break to type up your questions. We encourage you to do that as soon as they occur to you. But again, we won't actually address them until the designated breaks for Q&A. Another reminder for everybody is that today's session, the instructors are encouraging you, if you have a copy of Pro-UCL available to you, to actually open up the application and have that running so that as the instructors are going through their materials, you can actually play along with the software and follow along with some of their examples. A final reminder is that today's session is being recorded, and it will be available for you to download or replay for free in about 1 to 2 weeks. Everyone who registered for today will automatically get a reminder email from us as soon as that recording is available. If you encounter any technical difficulties, you can certainly email me or use that question mark button to report them. Just be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached so we can help you troubleshoot whatever the issue is. At the end of today's seminar, I'm going to point everybody to two important links. One of them will be a links or resources page where you can download not only the slides but other resources that are related to today's session, including access the Pro-UCL homepage and actually get a copy of the software if you don't already have one. The other link that I'll point everybody to is a short feedback form. If you're looking to get verification of your participation today, you'll want to be sure to take a minute to fill that form out. Okay, with that, I think those are the end of the reminders I have for today's session. So I'm going to turn things over to Felicia Barnett. I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number three. And Felicia, if you're ready to make a few opening statements, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Jane. Good afternoon or morning to those. I'm Felicia Barnett, and I'm the director of the Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center in EPA's Office of Research and Development. And the center has been responsible for creating, maintaining ProUCL for started with Superfund use, but I know it's widely used in some other areas. And so over we've been having these two seminars that aid people in those who don't know a lot about ProUCL and those who spend a lot of time on it with some of the new updates that we've come out with, and also to respond to questions we get very frequently. We appreciate people sending in. My name's on the webpage with my email address. We appreciate all the comments that we get because we try to keep it as up-to-date as we possibly can, and certainly a lot of the questions we have been asked over the years have aided in that endeavor. And for those who were not on the last webinar, we just put out 4.1, which is on a new web page. So just so you know that, or you're going looking, we've had to move it because of some of the internal movements of the program. But it is available now, and it started as first of this month. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and get us started, and because we have a lot of material to cover, and turn it over to Dr. Anita Singh, who will start off our presentation.
Thank you, Felicia, and welcome, everybody. We will continue going over various modules in ProUCL. Today, we will start with the hypothesis testing module. We are on slide 3, so let's move to slide 4. And the focus of the seminar will be to show the participants how to perform single and two sample hypothesis tests for data sets with non-detects as well as without non-detects, perform one-way ANOVA, this is new in ProUCL 4.1, compute background threshold values, estimate not to exceed values or background level concentrations, perform trend analysis using linear regression, Mann-Kendall trend test, tiles and trend test. This module is also new in 4.1. And estimation of mean standard deviation, various upper limits such as upper confidence limits, upper prediction limits, and tolerance limits based upon data sets with non-detect observations. Some of the participants in last webinar a week ago, they wanted to see KM method, which we will be covering today for data sets with non-detect. Next slide, number 5. So in this hypothesis testing module, we have two statements. One is called null hypothesis and other is alternative. Based upon the data, collected data, we state a null hypothesis, also known as baseline condition, and we test that versus alternative hypothesis. An example here, the site mean is less than or equal to cleanup standard, meaning, you know, let's say after some remediation, our site mean meets the cleanup standard versus the alternative that the site mean does not meet the cleanup standard. However, since in all the statistics is in all statistical tests, whether it's estimation or hypothesis, they are based upon sample data. So we can never, you know, sample the entire population. We don't know what's happening in the entire population. So the statistics based upon data, they suffer from uncertainties. You know, we went over this issue probably in little detail last time, and we will not be able to do that today. But however, you know, next slide, number 6. However, I will briefly define, you know, what kind of errors we can make using those statistics. You know, I mean, those are called decision errors, and they are well known as by type 1 error, which is the probability of rejecting a null statement when in fact it's true. It's, you know, it has several names. It's also called false positive, It can be, it's denoted by alpha, false rejection rate, type 2 error, probability of not rejecting the null statement when in fact it's false. And it has several names. It's normally denoted by beta. And all these, you know, desired values of alpha and beta, and in and the width of the gray region, which we went over last time, they are specified in DQOs, and based upon those DQOs, you know, people or the practitioners, they come up with some sample sizes which need to be collected from the media of interest to address project objectives, such as estimation of mean or comparing background concentrations with site concentrations and so forth. Sample size determination we also went over last webinar a week ago. Next slide, number 7, p-values. You know, p-values are associated with the test statistic. You know, based upon our data, we are computing something which is called test statistic, and typically, 5% level of significance is commonly used. You know, sometimes 1% and 10% are also used. So, you know, p-value releases us from looking up the, you know, lookup tables. You know, that was in those days when we did not have computing powers and the software were not able to compute the p-values. So, you know, in ProUCL, most of the test statistics have a p-value, and when the p-values are small, smaller the p-value, you know, the more evidence you have to detect the null hypothesis. If you think, you know, 0.05 level is your level of significance and p-value is smaller than 0.05, then you will reject the null hypothesis at 5% level of significance. Slide 8. Here are some of the, you know, tests. You know, if you have ProUCL 4.1 on your window, you can see that too. You know, you have to have a data set open. So if you go to the hypothesis testing, you know, menu up there, you know, we have single sample hypothesis, two sample hypothesis. We can do that for full data set without non-detects and with non-detects. And in order for non-detect, you know, options to get activated, your data set should have a non-detect column. And on this slide 8, we are seeing single sample hypothesis tests available. Intro UCL, t-test, proportion test, sign test, Wilcoxon sign rank test. And the options for single sample hypothesis, such as t-test here, you know, you test the mean concentration of your population is less than the action level. That's form 1. It's also known as form 1 hypothesis. Mean is greater than action level. Mean is greater than action level plus some value S. It's kind of called a substantial distance. This value should be determined by the project team. We also have capability of performing two-sided alternative. Mean equals the action level versus the alternative hypothesis that is not equal to the action level. And all these four forms of null and alternative hypotheses are described in detail in the EPA 2002 background document. And that's why, you know, we included this hypothesis testing module in ProUCL after that document came in. That's why we have these various forms of hypothesis testing. You pick a variable on which you want to perform your t-test, single sample t-test, and here we picked up manganese, and various other statistical methods in ProUCL, t-test also can be performed by group if you have multiple populations, and for each variable, we need to have an action level, you know, because we are comparing the hypothesis that the mean concentration is less than or equal to action level and so forth. So user has to specify that. Slide 9. So just, I'm trying to show here that the single sample hypothesis can be used to verify attainment of cleanup standards. And depending upon your data distribution, we can use parametric or non-parametric tests. T-test, of course, is parametric. And sign test, Wilcoxon sign rank test, and proportion test, they are non-parametric. And note here, Wilcoxon sign rank test, which is WSR test, is more powerful than the sign test. Slide 10. You know, this data set, you know, we have taken from EPA guidance documents. The data points are given there. The cleanup standard is 95. And based upon this data, our objective is to determine whether this area where we have collected the samples meets the cleanup standard or not. And that's how we have specified the hypothesis. Now we want to use t-test, so we need to know whether the data are normally distributed or not. T-test can be used when the data are normally distributed or at least approximately normally distributed. And using one of the goodness of fit tests we discussed last time, we determine here the data are normal because the p-value is 0.65, much greater than 0.05, as shown by the arrow there. So we know the data are normally distributed, so we can use t-test. Let's move on to slide 11. And this is the ProUCL generated output. It prints out various statistics of interest. And due to the time limitation, I will just concentrate on the test value, the value of the t statistic, and the critical value and the p-value, and then try to show how to interpret these results. So the test value is 1.26. Critical value at 0.05% level of significance is 1.86. And our null hypothesis is that the mean is less than or equal to 95. So the values of the test statistic, larger values, will cause the rejection of the null hypothesis. So we will compare the test value with the critical value. If the test value exceeds the critical value, then you reject the null hypothesis. In this case, that's not the case. So we do not reject the null hypothesis at 0.05 level of significance. And, for those of you who are used to using p-value, which is very good. You know, p-value here is 0.12. So, you know, we know at 0.05 level or for any significance level less than 0.12, we will not reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the site or the area of the site meets the cleanup standard. Next slide, number 12, sign test. And this is, you know, these are the same things which apply to Wilcoxon sign rank test, so I will not go over those again in my next few slides. So sign test is used when data set is not normal or it consists of non-detects. So here we are dealing with this manganese data set of size 16. The cleanup threshold is 1500. And one thing I want to point out, the t-test compares the mean to certain threshold. These non-parametric tests, they compare the median with the threshold. So because we are going to use non-parametric, so we are testing the statement that the mean of well 8 is less than or equal to 1500, meets the threshold, versus it does not. Next slide. 13, And just one more time, we tested whether the data are normal or not, and apparently it's not because p-value is very small. So just to make sure that we have to use non-parametric test, that's the normal process, you know, one should follow. And based upon the data distribution, we use parametric or non-parametric test. Next slide, number 14. You know, I cannot emphasize enough the usefulness of graphical displays. So that's why I brought this graph again one more time. We went over in detail the box plots. And this is the box plot of the manganese data from well 8. And the cleanup threshold is also drawn on this graph, which is 1500. The mean concentration is shown there, which is 1998. The median is 1750. So just by looking at this graph, you know, we know that the median and the most of the population or most of the data for this sample, you know, it's above the threshold. So my hypothesis should conclude that the mean concentration is greater than 1500 or the site does not meet the cleanup standard. Let's go to next slide, which is 15. Here is the output for sign test. The p-value is 0.059, meaning at, you know, the typical level of significance is 0.05, so one will not reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the site median is less than 1500 and meets the cleanup standard. So the sign test is not that powerful. So what we are seeing, the lesson we learned from here, you know, always, you know, these are formal tests. Sometimes, you know, some of these tests, they don't perform that well. They don't have high power. So always supplement your results with graphical displays. And if possible, if there are other tests available, you know, make your conclusion based upon perhaps more than one test. So in this case, we have a test, Wilcoxon sign rank test, and we will use that. Next slide, number 16. So same data using the option of Wilcoxon sign rank test and using the same form 1 hypothesis. Next slide, 17. Here are the results for WSR test. The p-value here is 0.0034. So we are going to reject the null hypothesis for all levels of significance greater than that value. So at 0.05, you reject it. You know, the critical value is also given there. The test value is given there. Since the test value is greater than the critical value, remember, our alternative is right-sided. So the larger values of the test statistic are going to cause the rejection. So 105 is greater than 101, so you reject the null hypothesis. And the p-value is also suggesting the same thing. And this conclusion is also verified by our graphical display. So I just wanted to point out, you know, sign test is used, you know, these non-parametric tests are described in detail in MARSUM documents, and they are routinely used when you are dealing with radionuclides, they routinely use these tests. So I'm suggesting maybe use both tests to determine whether your site meets the reference standard or not. Next slide, number 18, proportion test. I just need to make sure I'm not going. And I also have ANOVA, and I really want to go over ANOVA. So, because I have too many tests, I wanted to show you. So I'm going to skip this proportion test. It's very easy, and I have written the details on these slides 18, and 19, and if any one of you have questions, you can send me an email and then I will be very happy to go over these on an individual basis, but I think I'm running short on time. I also have to go to 2 sample tests in ANOVA, so I'm going to pass these. Slide 20 has the results, the p-value and all that, the same thing. Slide 21, now we have 2 sample hypothesis tests. So we have 2 sample hypothesis tests for data sets with non-detect and without non-detect. For full data sets, we have t-test, which assumes normality of both populations. And we also have non-parametric 2 sample tests, Wilcox and Van Whitney, and quantile test. And later on, I will show you which tests are available for data sets with NDs. Next few slides. So, here are the various options. You know, you can do 2 sample hypothesis tests when the data are in 2 different columns. One column can be background column, another column can be your area of concern. The data are in 2 different columns. A lot of times you have data in the same column and it's coded. The data by variable. So group 1 may represent your background population, group 2 may represent your on-site population, and so, I have shown you here example for with group option. So you have a well ID, and then you pick your up gradient well, which is 1, you pick your down gradient well, which is 9 here. Next slide, 22. The hypothesis we will be testing is the mean is less than or equal to the background mean versus the alternative hypothesis, the mean is greater than the background mean. Next slide, 23. Here is the monitoring well data 9 and the upgradient well data and the hypothesis null and alternative statements given there. And t-test requires data sets to be normally distributed. Next slide. And I will not go the details. These are the goodness of fit test for normal distribution and both data sets pass normality. So we can use t-test. Next slide, 25. Again, the graphical display. It's a quick snap of data, immediately tells me what's going on. Monitoring well 9 has much higher concentration than manganese, not only the mean, but the overall. Next slide, another graphical display, point by point comparison. We know by looking at this graph, manganese of well 9 is consistently greater than manganese concentration of well 1. Next slide, 27. Here are the results for the t-test, and the main inference statistics are given on the right-hand side box. T-test value is 11.64. There are two t-test statistics available in POUCL. One assumes that the variance of the 2 samples are equal, and the other one does not assume that, which is Sather-Waits unequal variance test. And POUCL can also perform F-test to compare the variances of 2 populations. And that's given there at the bottom, test of equality of variances. P-value is 0. So you reject the null hypothesis that the variances are the same, and conclude the variances of the 2 groups are significantly different, and that's why we will use Welch's Sather-Waits test, t-test, for unequal variances. And p-value is 0, so we conclude that reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the site mean is greater than the background mean. Next slide, 28. It's a Wilcox and Van Whitney test. It can also, it's a non-parametric, and it can also be used on data sets with non-detect, provided we are dealing with the single detection limit. In this case, this is again a real data set, and we are dealing with very small data sets, and in this for this particular side, they could not collect more background data. So, you know, when you're dealing with small data sets, it's hard to verify distributional assumption. You could, you know, I mean, I think we did that in the next few slides. But when you're dealing with such small data sets, you know, you may conclude data are normal or not normal, but, you know, the conclusion is probably not that strong. And actually here on the next slide, we are concluding the data are not normally distributed, so we cannot use t-test. And then here is the box plot, which is saying that the on-site lead is much greater than the background lead. And then the on slide 31, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention some of the slides in between because those were graphs. Now I'm on slide 31, and here are the various summary statistics given on the top of the left box, and then the Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test statistics are summarized there at the bottom. Test statistic is use statistic, which is 58. The critical value is 45, and because the null hypothesis we were testing was the site concentration are comparable to background concentration, so the larger values of the test statistic, which kind of fall in the rejection region, are going to cause the rejection of the null hypothesis. 58 is greater than the critical value, 0.05, so you reject the null hypothesis. Alternatively, you can just use the p-value, approximate p-value, which assumes normality, and the p-value is very small, so reject, and smaller than 0.05, so reject the null hypothesis. I do want to point out these approximate p-value, which assume normality, they are good when the data sets are kind of large, 20 for site and 20 for background. Sometimes they say even 10 and 10 are fine. So UCL computes exact critical value for samples of sizes up to 20 for both groups, but we also provide the approximate critical value just for additional information. Next slide, 32. The Gehan test, we use that when we are dealing with data sets with non-detect and we have multiple detection limits. It's also a two-sample test. So here we are comparing surface arsenic is comparable to the subsurface arsenic versus that's not true. And this kind of hypothesis of interest when you have to compute estimates for background threshold value. You know, you have surface and subsurface samples, and instead of computing the background threshold value separately for two layers, surface and subsurface, you may want to merge it. So in order to merge that, you have to test these kind of hypotheses. Slide 33. You know, I mean, we just plotted the multiple QK plot. It gives us a picture of arsenic in subsurface shown in blue and arsenic in surface shown in green, and the non-detects are shown in red. So you can see non-detects are greater than the detection limit. I mean, non-detects are greater than the observed detected values, and we have various detection limits. So next slide, 34, we use the Gehan's test, and the hypothesis is median of surface equals median of subsurface, and the test statistic, Gehan's test value, transformed a normal transformation there. It's minus 0.53, and the p-value is 0.12. P-value is much larger than 0.05, so we do not reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the site median is comparable to, I mean, subsurface median is comparable to subsurface median. So one can merge the subsurface and surface data to compute a single estimate of background values, which we will go over later today. Next slide, 35. And again, I do want to go over, and I'm already past my time, so I'm going to, but I do have time, I'm sorry. I was looking, it's 35 minutes, it's not ending at 10:35. So I still have 10 more minutes. So I will deal with this, example given on slide 35. I just want to make point out that Gahan test should be used when you are dealing with multiple detection limits. In practice, we have noticed, you know, people tend to use Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test when we have multiple detection limits, and then the conclusion may not be correct. And here is an illustration there. It's this data data set comes from a real site, and the graphical display is immediately telling me the site concentrations are higher than the background concentration, and because I have non-detect in my data, I cannot use t-test, so I have to use non-parametric test for data sets with non-detect. Next slide, 36. You know, we have 10 data points from both populations. 20% non-detect from site data, 40% non-detect from background data. I'm reading the output on the left box here. And you notice that statement in red, Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test, which we should not have used, you know, but it's sometimes used in practice, so I just wanted to specify that in Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test, all observations less than the maximum detection limit or maximum non-detect, which is 35, they are ranked the same, because Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test is meant only for single detection limit. And here is the conclusion on the right side for Wilcoxon-Mann-Whitney test. The p-value is 0.236, which is greater than 0.05. So one will conclude that don't reject the null hypothesis and site concentration to background concentrations. Next slide, which is of course an incorrect conclusion because we saw that in the graphical display on slide 35. The next slide, which is a Gahan test, which accommodates multiple detection limits, and here are the same statistics of interest on the upper box on the left-hand side, and on the bottom we have Gahan test value, which is 1.76, the critical value, which is 1.64, and the p-value, which is 0.038. So p-value is it's smaller than 0.05, meaning we will reject the null hypothesis, and we will conclude that site median is greater than the background median. So they are, you know, those concentrations are not comparable.
Okay. Well, I think if we
Anita, go ahead. You can continue to talk past that.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's on the sidewalk, so, you know.
So next slide is 38. Okay, this is one-way analysis variance. It's new in for UCL. It's meant when we are dealing with more than two groups. For two groups, we have T-test, which we just went over,
yeah,
to sample T-test. Or for two groups, we have Wilcox and Mann-Whitney test, which we just went over. But when we have to compare multiple groups, like multiple monitoring wells or interval comparisons, or comparing arsenic in various areas of concern, then we can use ANOVA. Pro-UC has classical ANOVA, which assumes normality, and non-parametric ANOVA, which is called, you know, Kruskal and Wallis test. So, and because we have multiple groups, multiple data sets, multiple groups, so you have to have a group ID, and so that's just an example, of the pro-UCL variable selection option. Now, next slide, 39. It's a real data set, polonium-210, from three reference areas. And they went, they worked really hard to choose those three reference areas. They were from different formations, and they wanted to know whether they can merge data from those three reference areas to establish a background threshold values. So before you do that, you have to demonstrate that these the concentrations in these three reference areas are comparable. So in the background for ANOVA, we are testing the null hypothesis that the concentrations, polonium-210 in this case, of the various areas, in this case three areas, are comparable versus that they are not comparable.
Yeah.
Next slide, number 40. Again, the graphical displays. The first is a side-by-side box chart that suggests me that polonium in these three groups or three reference areas are comparable. And the QQ plot at the bottom is also suggesting that, it gives me, a little more information that polonium in area RP is probably lower, but it's a lower end. But when you go to the higher concentrations, they are pretty much the same. Next slide, 41. Here are the results of classical one-way ANOVA, which assumes that the data from the three groups are normally distributed. And we did that. In this case, those data from three groups are normally distributed. I have not included those results. And at the bottom half, the classical one-way variance table there, it gives you, the upper half gives you the mean and the standard deviation and the variance of those groups. And in the bottom, there's a lot of statistics behind these, sum of squares and the degrees of freedom, mean square error, and so forth. But the only statistic which I will be talking about today is this p-value. And that p-value is associated with F statistic. And in this case, it's 0.06, which is greater than 0.05. So we will not reject the null hypothesis at 0.05 level of significance, and we conclude that the mean concentrations of the three reference areas, LR, RP, and BP, are comparable. They potentially come from a single population. Next slide, 42. Now, we also have Kruskal and Wallis test, which is meant for non-parametric data sets which are not normally distributed. So now we will go back to our manganese data. We had earlier three wells, upgrading well 1 and two other monitoring wells 8 and 9. So we are comparing concentrations of those, and we knew that well 8 did not follow a normal distribution, so we can perform Kruskal and Wallis test. Slide 43. And then here are the results of the test. It gives you the observation numbers and the group IDs, the median of those groups. And at the bottom, you have KWH statistic, denoted by H, the degrees of freedom, and the p-values. Those p-values are based upon a test statistic, which is used, based upon chi-square distribution, the test statistic H that follows chi-square distribution. This approximation is good when you have at least 5 observations from each group. So I just want to, mention that. And there could be, because KW test is based upon ordered statistics, there could be ties. So the test statistic, H test statistic, is computed 2 different ways. The first one without ties and the second one adjusted for ties. So the conclusion here, the p-value is small, so we conclude that the MW concentrations in 3 wells are significantly different. So that concludes this first section. And I'm on slide 44. And this section deals with estimation of background threshold values. The statistics which are used to estimate BTVs are upper percentiles, upper prediction limits, upper tolerance limits. There are others also, but for now we are just going to talk about these 3. Next slide, 45. This section, is based upon the background module of ProUCL. You see there is a module, if you go to the menu, background. So all the examples, you can use these UPLs and UTLs for various statistical applications. But in this presentation, we are just talking about their usage as estimates of BTVs. So before you start computing those statistics, make sure your data is an established background data, meaning it's free of potential outliers representing impacted site observations. So these BTVs, are often used to identify contaminants of potential concern, determine potentially polluted site locations, perform intra-well comparison to identify non-complying wells. In groundwater monitoring, they compute the prediction limits, for a well, and then the future observation, a single or many future observations from that well, are compared with the prediction limit. They tend to use prediction limits. So we have, I'm just trying to point out here, this module can also be used to perform intra-well comparisons. Next slide, 46. This is a real data set of size 39. And we want to compute UTLs and UPLs. And ProUCL can compute these for data sets without NDs, and that's what we will be covering in this section. In section 10, we will be discussing how to compute these statistics for data sets with non-detect. So that should, the process, one should follow to estimate BTVs is first make sure you have established background data, and then make sure there are no outliers, and then you determine your data distribution. Depending upon the data distribution, you use a parametric or non-parametric method. There are several parametric methods here based upon normal, gamma, and log normal distribution, and then non-parametric methods which are typically based upon order statistics for full data sets. And then we also have an all option when we can compute statistics for, you know, all the statistics available in ProUCL. You know, I will show you in output. You know, it will print out statistics based upon normal, gamma, log normal, and it will also tell you whether the data are normal, gamma, or whatnot. And then it doesn't make recommendations because it's not, it depends upon your application, whether you use percentiles as an estimate of background threshold value, or UPLs, or UTLs. So the project team should determine which statistic to use. And then all the statistics are computed. So the, you know, once you have the output, the project team should decide whether they want to use UPL as estimates of BTVs or UTL as estimate of BTVs. So here, I'm still on slide 46. So there is a confidence level. You know, you want to compute 95% upper prediction limit for three future observations. So you, you know, right now it says different or future K values. So if you have three future observations, you enter three there. And the coverage number is 0.9. This is associated with tolerance limit. It's the, you know, upper tolerance limit is the confidence interval on the upper percentile. So this coverage represents that percentile, you know. So if you want, and I will go over again, this thing, I think it's too much information I'm providing, so I will illustrate this point later when we really compute UTL. Slide 47, you know, I like graphical displays, and so I keep using them, and based upon that data, quickly wanted to see how it looks, and we noted there is one outlier. For sure. So next slide, 48. So we went ahead and tested. You know, I knew that there is at least one outlier. So in this case, we tested for three outliers. We are dealing with a large data set of size 25. I mean, of size greater than 25, so I can use Rosner test. So at 5% level, it tells me there are two potential outliers, 63.9 and 5.8, and at 1%, only 63.9 is an outlier. So obviously 63.9 is an extreme outlier, and that 5.8 outlier, the project team may decide what to do with it, to include in your calculations or not. In following slides, now we are including 5.8 as the valid observation of that background data and excluding 63.9. Slide 49. Now, you know, once outliers are out, you want to know what kind of data distribution data set follows. We tested for normality. The p-value is almost zero, so we reject the null hypothesis and could conclude that are not normal. Next slide. 50. Test well, you know, we think, you know, I have gone over quite a bit on how to read test statistics and p-values for various goodness of fit tests. You know, here the goodness of fit test for gamma distribution, the upper graph and the lower graph is for log normal. Both tests are telling me the data are gamma distributed as well as log normally distributed. So next slide, 51. Now here, the BTV estimates using that background option, and I think we selected optional option, and that's why here, you know, this is part of the output, and here we have test statistics for normality. And there is a conclusion that data are not normally distributed, shown in red. And then the gamma distribution test was performed. And It says the data are gamma distributed, log normal distribution tests are performed. It says data are not log normally distributed. So log normal distribution rate test statistics, I mean, the estimates of VTVs are shown on the right hand side. When it says assuming log normal distribution, it says 95 UTL with 95% coverage. So what it is, it's confidence limit, upper confidence limit on the 95th percentile with confidence coefficient of 0.95. So that's the coverage. Coverage is kind of related to the percentile. And the second, right below it is 95% UPL. It's 4.48 and so forth. The various percentiles, parametric percentiles are computed also for log normal distribution. And next slide has other statistics. On slide 52. Various gamma statistics are given in the left panel and non-parametric statistics are given on the right panel there on that big table. So we have gamma percentiles, we have upper prediction limits for gamma distribution, we have tolerance limit for gamma distribution. There are two methods you can compute. In practice, they result fairly close, you know, they yield fairly close results. WH is Wilson-Hilferty test and HW is Hawkins-Wixley test. You know, those two people develop that test statistic or approximation for, they came up with approximation to compute gamma UPM. On the right hand side, in the red box, now I have summarized the results, estimates of BTV, gamma distribution based, and log normal distribution based. 95% UPL for gamma is 4.12, and for log normal is 4.48. So the log normal distribution typically yields higher values than the gamma distribution, and they both are, you know, can be used. In this case, the difference is not that significant, but I will show you some examples later where the difference can be unrealistically large. So my recommendation here is use of UPLs and UTLs based upon gamma distribution is suggested whenever applicable, meaning whenever there are gamma distributed. Next slide, 53. Now here is the data, I think we discussed it on last Wednesday when dealing with UCLs, computing UCLs. So it's the same Magnis data. Let's compute the prediction limits and the tolerance limit just to show how outliers can influence these statistics. The data set with these two outliers and without these two outliers follow gamma as well as log normal distribution with and without outliers. So it's, you know, the project team should decide whether they should include these in the computation of estimates of BTVs or not. Next slide, 54, it's just the what I just said, the data are normally distributed with outliers. Here are the statistics using the entire data set of 17, including the outliers. And you see, assuming log normal distribution, the 95% UTL with 95% coverage is 18,000, whereas the maximum value of this data is only 4,300. So many times larger than the maximum value. And UPL is also significantly higher. Next slide has gamma statistics. On the left-hand side, you have WHUPL and XWUPL, and then UTLs are there also, 95%. And on the right-hand side, you have various non-parametric statistics. And because these are based upon order statistics, you know, typically, you know, the 95-95 UTL or 95 UPL, they kind of land on the maximum value, and that's what's happening in this case. If you remember, I just mentioned the maximum value was 43, so the non-parametric limits are all 4300. Slide 57. Now we are computing the same thing, all those estimates of BTVs without those two outliers. On the right hand side, elevated log normal estimates. UTL is 9,666 and UPL for log normal distribution is 3,417. And without the outliers, the maximum value is only 1,490. Next slide, 58. I have gamma distribution based estimates of BTVs. So 95% UPL is 2,039 and UTL, 95-95 UTL is 3,556. And on the right-hand side, you can see the non-parametric statistics are still landing on the maximum value. Next slide, 59. Here's the summary, just to show you, you know, how outliers can influence various statistics. And so it's very important that the entire project team should get involved in making a decision what to do with the outlying observations. I think I mentioned we are on slide 59, and if you look at this table there, of course we cannot use normal UPLs because that are not normally distributed gamma UPLs using WH approximation, including the outliers, 3,423, without the outliers, it's 1,863. So there is a tremendous difference. And the UPL, you know, for long normal distribution, kind of cut down in pretty much in half. Next slide, we have the UTLs. With outliers and without outliers, the long normal distribution, which is commonly used still, you know, you can see the 95 UTL is 18,000. With outliers and without outliers is 9,666. Gamma UTLs using WS method are given there in blue. So that would be my recommendation if people have to use this. You know, I do want to point out, even, you know, everybody kind of knows now that the UCLs for log normal distribution, they get really distorted when the log normal distribution is highly skewed and we are dealing with data sets of small sizes. Same thing happens for UPLs and UTLs as seen here. You know, I mean, they think the log normal estimates of UPL and UTLs, they don't get that unrealistic. But here's an example where you can see that. So I just wanted to point that out. Next slide, 61. I hurriedly went through, so I'm kind of before time here. Steps to estimate BTVs. Make sure there are no significant outliers or multiple populations present in your background data set. Always use graphical displays. perform goodness of fit tests to determine data distribution. Depending upon data distribution, use an appropriate parametric or non-parametric estimator, ETV. You may want to consult a statistician for further clarification. Okay. Am I right on time here?
You're maybe a few minutes early, but we're good, Anita. We can start and take a break now. Everybody needs to take a break for a second if they need to get up and stretch or something like that. And certainly now we start also, too, if there's any questions, we'll take about 15 minutes to for a break and then and answer any questions that anybody has. Jean, do we want to start east to west?
Yep, we're going to start with the telephone participants. And so for those of you who are on the phone lines, we have tried to globally mute all the lines, although it did sound like somebody managed to unmute and talk through it. So I apologize for that. If you are on the phones, please keep yourself on mute. You can use your own mute button or hit, star six to mute your phone lines. For right now, I'm going to let people in the East Coast, we're going to work from time zone to time zone, ask a question while we're on break. If you're on the East Coast, so you're in the Eastern time zone, and you'd like to ask a question, you'll need to first unmute your phone line by hitting pound six. Then you can identify yourself and feel free to ask your question. So again, East Coast only, hit pound six, identify yourself or your organization, and then ask your question. Okay, we'll move along to the very next time zone, which is the Central time zone. If anyone in Central time zone has a question, hit pound six, identify yourself, and then ask your question. Okay, I'm going to move ahead to the Mountain time zone. Anyone in the Mountain time zone, pound six, and then please identify themselves and ask your question. All right, and then we'll go over to the Pacific time zone. Anyone on the far west coast, if you have a question, please hit pound six. You can identify yourself and ask your question. Okay, since I don't hear anything on the telephone line, I've got a number of questions that have been submitted electronically, and I'm going to start with those. For those who are in a different time zone, if you're an international caller, we'll switch back to you in a few seconds and give you a chance to ask your question by phone. If you're streaming the audio, you can continue to type up those questions and comments, and we will continue to go through them throughout our break, and then again, we'll have more time reserved at the end of the session to address questions. So I'm going to start with the first question or comment that came in from the, I believe it's the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality in Lander, Wyoming. And they ask if you could make the example data sets available that are being used in the webinar.
Yes, certainly. I will send those off to Felicia. And Felicia probably can send it to you. And then, they can send me an email. I can send them directly.
If they want to send me an email and ask you for it, Anita, if you'll just send me the copies, then I can keep them, and we'll send them out to anybody who wants them.
Okay. Yeah, we will do that.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from NSAFE Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee, and they're referencing slide number 14. They say, on slide number 14, the box plot using manganese data, there are annotations on the plot that are not generated by ProUCL. How do you activate the labels or annotations to show the values?
Okay, on page 14, I'm going back there. Just bear with me. Which annotation you're talking about? This graph has been generated by ProUCL. Do you have a ProUCL on your computer?
Anita, those questions were typed up. So for the individual who made that comment or question, you can continue to provide a supplemental response if you like, and we'll get back to you. But I'm looking at slide number 14, Anita, and there are a few additional annotations. For example, the first one that I see is at, it looks like 1500. There's red text that I believe says threshold and has a number next to it.
Yeah, that is generated by ProUCL. And I think I briefly went over this option last time when you go into your box plots, and then before you hit the OK button, you know, there is a panel, and up to four horizontal lines can be drawn on box plot. So you type on the left, I think, the label, you type whatever, and on the right, you type the value, and that's how I did that. And this graph is completely generated by ProUCL.
And the other text is like
1270 and 1998, the mean values and all that, they are also printed by ProUCL. And, you know, the people who have this question, if they cannot do it, you can send an email to Felicia, or I can look into this. You know, if you still cannot generate it, we can help you out with that later on.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is coming in from E&E Incorporated in Chicago, Illinois. And they ask, when you have two tests that give opposite results, for example, the sine and WSR tests, which test do you rely upon? Does a smaller p-value indicate a more powerful test?
As when we were going over those tests, as I said, WSR test is more powerful. So, you know, in this case, we do know that WSR test is more powerful than sine test, so we will use that. And always supplement your test statistics with graphical displays. You know, they tell you a whole lot. You know, then you can get from a test statistic. You know, the test statistics are formal, but there is no substitute for graphical displays. And, you know, the p-value, in some cases we compute the p-values using approximations, like Kruskal and Wallis test. You know, I was using, you know, I mean, you know, these non-parametric tests, they are based upon order statistics, so it's very hard to compute the critical values. So, you know, statisticians have developed some approximate test statistics, you know, like in the Kruskal and Wallis test, you know, it follows chi-squared, and then I can compute a p-value for chi-squared approximation. So more than p-value, you know, as a yardstick, use your graphical displays if you don't know the information, whether which test is more powerful. But, you know, typically we do know which test is more powerful. For example, for testing for normality, we know Shapiro-Wilk test is the most powerful test. When the data are normally distributed, the t-test is the most powerful test to compare the two means. So use the most powerful test, supplement your results by graphical displays.
Okay, thank you. The next question comes from EPA Region 10 out in Seattle, Washington. And I'm going to paraphrase what he's saying, but I believe he's asking, why would you base a decision on median unless their data is insufficient to support a mean comparison?
That's kind of a quality question. In environmental applications, risk assessment, all the decisions are made based upon the mean concentration. And I just wanted to stress here, these Wilcoxon, Mann-Whitney test, or the sine test, you know, they are used routinely, but they are testing the median. If that suits your need, you know, for whatever, then use it. I also want to add in one more thing, the test, which is called the quantile test. So UCL also has quantile test, and we could not go over this due to time limitations. The non-parametric tests such as Wilcoxon, Mann-Whitney test and quantile test, they are used simultaneously to determine the data distribution. We'll rank some tests. We'll test for your median. But, you know, and you can conclude that the two medians are the same. But at the same time, the tails or the high end of your data could be significantly different. So when you want to test for the entire data set, entire distribution of the data set, then these quantile tests and the Wilcoxon rank sum test should be used in tandem. So I just wanted to point out that the median, some of these tests, you know, can do only so much. They can just test for medians. You know, one common application of Wilcoxon rank sum test is people tend to take log transformation of your original data and then determine that the mean concentration in the log scale is the same. And in the log scale, the mean concentration being the same is not the same as the mean concentration on the original scale. You know, what you're test comparing is just the two medians. So, you know, depending upon your application, you know, you may want to use median, or if you're using certain tests, you should be aware of the fact that you are comparing the median or the mean. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is coming in from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in St. Paul, Minnesota, and they ask for the Gahan test, what is the maximum percentage of non-detects that can be used in this test? I noticed that your example went up to 50% non-detects.
Yeah.
This is Bob. Could you get their email address? I think neither. I'll have to go into my code and figure out if I can do more than 50%. I believe that might be as far as I can go, but I'll have to go research my code, and I don't think I can do it right off the top of either one of our heads.
Certainly. I'll be happy to share the person's contact information with you afterwards for a more extensive response. This next question, then, is coming in from Golder Associates in Redmond, Washington. And they ask, is the Gahan test still the most appropriate test when one-half DL is used in data sets to compare means?
In Gahan tests, I'm not substituting this one-half. You know, the Gahan test, the way ProUCL performs the computation, you know, whatever value you feed in, and typically you report the detection limit. So we just take the value as the detection limit and treat that as a non-detect. And we don't process it like half of the detection limit actually later on when we, you know, especially in estimation, I believe that section 10 later today, we will recommend. And it's not us, you know, it's just literature is abundant to not to use these proxy methods, you know, like replacing non-detects by zero or half of the detection limits or something else. And the Gahan test is not used on half of the detection limit data set.
Okay, thank you. Sure. The next question is coming in from Environ International Corp in Portland, Maine, and they ask, is it possible to have ProUCL transform your data prior to employing a non-parametric test?
What kind of a transformation? ProUCL does not have, I think, a transformation module. Another software, Scout, that has a module where you can transform your data. And ProUCL, however, has a small module where, you know, for data sets with non-detects, you can compute those or extrapolate non-detects using ROS methods, whether it's normal ROS or gamma ROS or log normal ROS. That's the only kind of transformation I will call, quote-unquote, we have in ProUCL, but I cannot perform, let's say, some log transformation beforehand in ProUCL. We do not have that. Okay?
Sure.
The next question is coming in from Arcadis in San Francisco, California, and they ask, can you talk about when it would be advised to use UPLs versus UTLs for the estimation of BTVs?
Again, this is, it's a policy question. My favorite will be UTL. I will go with the UTL provided my background data is really a background data. It does not consist of impacted location. And it's a policy kind of decision. The entire project team should make a decision whether they should use UPL or UTL. If your data set is really clean, then I would rather use UTL as an estimate of BTV because it limits the false positive error rate. Okay?
Okay, yep. We'll take a few more questions online before checking with our international callers. So this next question coming in is from E&E in Chicago, Illinois, and this is referencing slide number 46. They ask, when calculating a UPL for use as a BTV, what rationale should be selected or should be used to select an appropriate K value? And they have in parentheses, the size of the potential site data is set is unknown.
Okay, on slide 46. The K value is for future values. See, these UPLs, which are like upper prediction limits, they are computed for a single future observation. In that case, K will be 1. They can be computed for 2 future observations. In that case, K will be 2. They can be computed for 4 future observations. In that case, K will be 4. And I think in this process, ProUCL also computes the UPL for the mean of those 4 future observations if you pick K as 4. Is that, answer your question? Or there was something else? That's the only K I see on slide 46, and that K is associated with future observations.
Okay. And for the individual in Chicago, if you have additional clarifying remarks for your question or want more information on that, feel free to type up a clarifying response, and we'll get that to our instructors.
Right.
The next question is coming in from Arcadis in Syracuse, New York, and they ask, is one of the gamma approximations better than the other, and then in parentheses, WH or HW? Is there a rule of thumb that could be used to select one over the other?
They are the same. There is, we and the literature does not have any reference to say which one can be used. They pretty much result in comparable values. So, and I have not had chance to do some sort of simulation to make that recommendation. These two limits were suggested that we, it was suggested that we include these limits, by some people in headquarters. So we included that, and it makes sense. We reviewed the literature, but so far, we cannot tell you which one is better. It seems like they both are pretty good approximation. If the data are really well behaved, we did notice that if the data are well behaved, not highly skewed, they yield fairly similar results. Okay,
great. I think we're coming up on the end of the break. We're going to take just 1 minute and see if we have any international phone callers who didn't have a chance to ask a question on the phone lines before. Again, if you're not in the East Central Mountain or Pacific time zone, so this is international callers, if you're on the phone lines and have a question, you can ask the question directly by hitting #6. Identify yourself and then ask the question directly. Okay, I don't hear any other questions on the phone lines.
Again, if you're streaming audio or you're looking at the slides, you can continue to type up your comments and questions. We'll take some additional time after we've gone through all of the remainder of the PowerPoint presentations. We have time at the end reserved for additional questions. So continue to type them up, and again, we'll continue to address them as well as work with those of you in the phone lines before we close out today to help answer questions. So with that, Felicia, if you're okay, we'll go back to the presentation material. I'll direct everybody to move back to slide number 62.
Thanks, Jean. I also want to say, you know, if you think of something after the fact, certainly you can email us and we'll be happy to respond to any additional questions, you know, related to the training or even just things that you run across as you use 4.1 since, of course, it is new. And with that, we're going to return to our presentation, starting with Dr. Anita Singh again. And then we'll end up with Nancy Jaholia. And go ahead, Anita.
Yeah, thanks, Felicia. So we are on page 62. So this is a new module, trend analysis. We have, let's go to page 63. Trend tests are used to determine if concentrations are decreasing or increasing over time. These trend tests can be used for any application. In environmental applications, they are commonly used in groundwater monitoring applications. They need to see if the trend in concentrations in groundwater are increasing or decreasing over time. In order to do so, we should have a time variable and the concentration variable of equal number of observations in your data set as shown in these arrows on the select variable box of ProUCL. And on the left, you know, it shows what kind of trend test we have. We can use regression, simple ordinary least square regression, Mann-Kendall test, Tile-Sain test, and then we have some time series plots which can be used to compare concentrations of multiple groups, multiple wells over time. Slide 64. Here is the linear regression. It's available in all statistical textbooks. Slope of the line determines the trend in data. Significant positive slope suggests upward trend. Significant negative slope suggests downward trend. And insignificant slope suggests no evidence of trend in data. How do we determine the significance of the slope? It's determined, you know, in the background we are again performing some hypothesis tests, and those tests have some p-values. So the p-value determine whether the test is or the slope is significant or not. I do want to point out that OLS is sensitive to outliers and it cannot be used with data sets for data sets with non-detects. And the inference, meaning determining whether the slope is in positive or significantly positive or not, those kind of inference, they assume that the residuals are normally distributed. So there are some restrictions for using regression line trend test. It's parametric, you can say it's parametric trend test. The next slide, 65. And again, I can provide the data set, and I think I used the data set last time. If you go back on slide 63, you know, I have the time variable, which is, I think it will be a good idea for me to go over this terminology on page 63, please. Dependent variable is your concentration variable. So here we are calling these values. These could be values of chromium, hexachromium in certain over certain period of time. So the values or the dependent variable are your concentration, and the independent variable is your time variable. You know, if you are computing these concentrations as a function of time, so for events, the sampling events or the time is your independent variable. And again, we can perform this regression by group. If you have multiple groups or multiple wells in your data set, so the regression can be performed by group. Now we will go to page 64. You know, I talked about the significance of the slope, but on the left side, we have options available. You know, this module can generate an OST file and also graphical display. In the graphical display, you have XY plot, so simple, you know, X-axis, which is time axis, and the Y-axis, the concentration axis. So you click on that box, so you will get that XY plot. And in addition to that, we, you know, for UCL can also compute the confidence interval and the prediction interval about that regression line. And those intervals are computed based upon the confidence coefficient you select here. On the left-hand side, you see those confidence coefficient. And then you can display the regression table in your OST file if you check that. And whatever confidence you select here, the 1 minus of that is used as your level of significance to determine whether the slope is significant or not. Okay, now let's go to next slide, which is 65. So using those options, on page 64, now we have the graphical display here. The XY line is shown in black, dotted, and all the points, pair data, events, time, I mean comma, concentrations, they are plotted there in blue squares, and then the green line represents the the confidence limit for the mean concentrations, and the red lines are the prediction intervals. And some statistics, relevant statistics are also shown on this graph. The slope is shown there, and the intercept is shown there, and so forth. The p-value there on the graph is the p-value for the regression as a whole. Whether it's a significant regression, it's a meaningful regression, or not. So p-value is small, so you reject the null hypothesis that the regression model is not significant, the slope and intercept, they don't make sense. So that's your null hypothesis, and you reject them, and the alternative is the regression model is good. So the p-value here for the regression model is associated with the regression as a whole, and we also have p-value for the slope, and which is in here on the right-hand side, regression estimates and inference table. Under parameter, you see intercept, so that's the inference on intercept, and under there, you also have events A. So that's the only dependent variable independent variable we have, the time, which is, you know, you can also say that instead of even say, we can say as slope. You know, this setup is coming from when we are dealing with the more than one independent variable. So, you know, it's new, and we were kind of working on limited budget. You know, for more explanation for, we can replace that word events A, which comes from the data, by slope. So that is our slope of the regression line. Its estimate is 34.19. Standard error is 4.6. And the test statistic to test its significance is statistic, which is 7.3, and the associated p-value is almost zero, 3.8 to the e to the minus 6, 10 to, times 10 to the minus 6. So p-value is zero, meaning reject the null hypothesis that the slope is zero in favor of the alternative that the slope is not zero. And in this case, you know, these are two-sided p-values. In this case, you know, we are testing for positive slope. You know, the slope is positive. That means it's an upward trend. And you can see that it's clear from the graphical display also. Next slide. Now let's move on to the non-parametric TAN test in ProUCL. Mann-Tandel test. And being non-parametric, it's less sensitive to outliers, and we can use that on data sets with moderate number of non-detects. And if you look at the right-hand side there, the graph, the GUI, select trend, event variables. This Mann-Tandel test is performed only on concentrations. In this case, value. And so if you don't need a graph, you don't, then you don't have to have a sampling event variable. But if you have it, then certainly you would like to look at your graphical display to see how the concentrations are behaving over time. So because I'm using the same data set, for that data set I do have the time variable represented by events underscore A. And the measure data is represented by values. And the significance of the Mann-Tandel test will be tested at 0.05 level. It's 1 minus of the confidence coefficient selected here highlighted in blue, 0.95. And, you know, you have an option to display graphs or not display graphs. If you want to display graphs, then you should have the time variable in your data set. And then to make this graph even more, you know, I mean, the trend test more formal, you can display these trend lines, you know, OLS line we have discussed so far. So I have selected that. Next slide, 67. So this is the graph generated using the options shown in the previous slides. Most of the relevant statistics are printed on this graph in that pink panel. You know the number of observations, the confidence coefficient, level of significance, the test value, S is denoted by S, and the tabulated p-value, standard deviation of the S statistic, its standardized value, normalized value, which is 4.11, and the approximate p-value goes with the standardized value, which follows normal 0-1 distribution. So for samples of size, you know, small samples, let's say size 10 or smaller, you know, people tend to use the exact p-value or the tabulated p-value. And for larger samples, we can use approximate p-value. I think in ProUCL, we have exact or the tabulated p-values for samples of size up to 23. And for higher sample sizes, we have approximate p-values. So what we are doing here, we are testing the hypothesis that there is no trend in data versus the alternative there is trend. Significant positive values of S or standardized S suggest upward trend. Significant negative values of S or standardized S suggest downward trend. And significance is determined using p-values. In this case, p-value is almost zero. So we conclude the data exhibit upward trend because S is positive, and not only that, it's significant at level of significance 0.05. Next slide, slide 68. So we also have tiles and trend line. So the options there, you select your confidence coefficient. You may want to compare the tile trend line with the OLS line. And note that the tile trend test is also non-parametric. So this is a non-parametric trend line we will be generating. And this test is not, it's less sensitive to outliers and can also tolerate moderate number of non-detects. So we are using the same data set, so I don't have to explain these time variable and the measurement variable, events underscore A, values A same. This is the output generated by tile sand test. Just for the sake of completion and for comparison, you know, in this output, you also get, whether you select it or not, Mann-Kendall test statistics and those relevant statistics, standard deviation 22. And this Mann-Kendall test is based upon slopes between consecutive points. So this information is for people who are familiar with how this tiles and tests is performed. For a typical user, you may not be interested in what these number of slopes and M1 and M2 statistics are. The relevant statistics, which will be used to determine whether trends are increasing or decreasing, are same tiles and slope, which is 31.71. Its intercept, these two values will help us draw the line, which will be shown on the next slide. And how do we determine the significance of this slope, 31.71? It's based upon the confidence interval about the slope. On the upper right-hand corner there, you notice the confidence coefficient is 0.95. So what we are going to do, we are going to compute a two-sided confidence interval around the slope. So we have a 95% lower confidence limit of the slope, 95% upper confidence limit of the slope. One value is 20, other value is 43.3. And the slope lies in there, and the tiles and slope based upon data, which is 31.71, so it is in there, and zero is not in this interval. The interval is 20, starting from 20 all the way up to 43.3, so it's a positive interval. Zero is not included. That means the slope, tiles and slope is not equal to zero. That's another way of testing hypothesis based upon confidence intervals. So the conclusion will be the slope is not equal to zero. Slope being positive, it is significant with the at the 4.05 level of significance. Okay, next slide. It's just a graph generated by this module. The tile trend line is shown in red and OLS is shown in blue. In this case, the non-parametric and parametric regression OLS line, they are fairly similar, and they both, you know, we have already discussed the OLS conclusion earlier, and here the Tile trend line is also suggesting that there is a significant upward trend in data. Next slide, 70. Now just for the, I noted the guidance for tile trend test in textbooks and even in some of the documents, it's not that clear. So I thought it would be useful to have an example showing a downward trend. So using the same procedure, using the same similar options, picking the graphical display and showing the trend tiles and trend line and OLS line, that's what we generated. And if you note it on the right hand panel there, the slope is negative and the confidence limit, the 95% confidence limit around the slope is starting from minus 43, ending, minus 43.95, and the upper limit of the slope is minus 37, so zero is not there. That means the slope is not equal to zero. Negative slope, it's not in the 95% confidence limit. The conclusion is there is a statistically significant evidence of decreasing trend. Okay, next slide, 71. You know, we went over some of these last Wednesday. I will briefly go over these again. We have several graphical displays in this module. You know, it's just simple time series plots. If you just want to see how concentrations are behaving over time. And if you do not have any time variable, you have just concentration variable, so in order to plot it, you can select some initial starting index value. The example we have shown here is just 1. And the increments, they are also shown as 1. And you can choose to display these regression lines and tile trend line on that graph, or you may ignore these. So using these options, the graph we get is given on slide 72. The first graph we did not choose to display trend lines, OLS and tiles in, so there is no trend data there. On the second, we chose to display those lines, so in all the statistics are displayed here. So the data set is of size 16 from some application. Next slide. I think you probably get the hang of this already, because we use these graphs when we were doing the test statistics, man candle test statistic and tile trend test statistic. So everything on slide 73 is kind of self-explanatory. So based upon these options, the only difference here in slide 73 and slide 71 and 72 is we have a time variable, events underscore A. In the earlier, we were fictitiously entering some index value starting from 1 with an increment of 1. And, we are just simply plotting these pairs. So, it's kind of simple scatter plot with ends joined. So, the next slide, 74. And since we use options, display these OLS line and tile trend line, all those statistics are shown there, and the conclusion based upon Thais and trend analysis also shown there. Slide 75. Yeah, that's kind of useful graph. You know, and one can use this when you have multiple areas of concern, multiple monitoring wells, and you want to see how they compare over a period of time. In order to use this option, each group in your comparison should have same number of observations. So, meaning, you know, you have, let's say, 10 monitoring wells, and you're collecting data quarterly, and you have two-year data from those 10 wells. So, 10, two-year data means 8. So, all those 10 wells should have 8 points, and then you can compare the concentration of those 10 wells, one on the top of other, or crisscrossing, depending upon how they behave. So that's the purpose of this graph. And you can formalize this graph by displaying these trend lines. You know, in this case, we have used display. You don't have to, you know. It gets busy when you have more groups. If you, on the top of those data from 10 groups, you also display these trend lines, then the graph can get busy, so you may not want to have them. But for this particular example, we have selected to display tile trend line, and result of these options selected on page 75 are shown on page 76. So here we have three wells. Well 1 shown in blue, concentrations there. Well 8 shown in green there, and well 9 shown in red. And then there is trend. So, you know, you can see tiles and slope for well 1, it's flat, and it's not clear that there is any evidence of any trends in other two wells. If you want to know whether there is, you know, those trends are significant or not, you can perform trend test. You know, we did not choose that option, so those statistics are not displayed on the right-hand side. I think with this, I conclude this section, and I move on to slide 77. Seems like we are kind of on time. This section, we will be dealing with the estimation of mean, variance, upper confidence limits, prediction limits, tolerance limits for data sets with non-detect observations. We have gone over various other things like graphical displays, hypothesis testing, you know, for data sets with non-detects. But so far, we have not actually computed estimates of mean, variance, and EPC terms, background threshold value for data sets with non-detects. And that's what we will be doing in this section. Slide 78. There are several methods available. Parametric methods, maximum likelihood estimation assumes normality, regression on ordered statistics, ROS. ProUCL can do that for normal distribution, denoted by NROS, log normal distribution, LROS. LROS method is very commonly used, and gamma ROS, GROS. Non-parametric methods in ProUCL are substitution methods such as DNO2, 0, or some other statistics in between, or some other values in between the 0 and the detection limit. Kaplan-Meier method is also called product limit estimator, and various bootstrap methods. KM method, Kaplan-Meier method, it comes from survival analysis, biostatistics, when people are suffering from terminal disease, so they want to estimate their mean survival time. And so KM method can be used for our environmental data set, less sensor data set consisting of non-detect by flipping, or it can be computed directly. Actually, ProUCL computes them directly. But for, because there was some interest in seeing KM method, so I thought I will give you a very brief history where it's coming from. For data sets with non-detect, non-parametric methods, such as KM method, are preferred, as distributional assumptions are hard to justify, especially when non-detect exceed your detected values, or when you have multiple detection limits. I have shown you several examples of these scenarios. I do want to point out, KM method, which is a non-parametric method, so it should be used on raw data. I've seen some examples, at least, in some cases, people tend to use KM method on log data. The log transformation is used when we want to use log normal distribution theory. There is no log normal distribution we are dealing here when we are using KM method. Because when you log transform your data, you compute your mean and standard deviation based upon KM method, and then you transform those back to the original scale by exponentiation. So there is transformation bias, and those results, typically they result in elevated values. I showed you earlier while dealing with data sets without non-detect, how log normal distribution based UTLs and UPLs were unrealistically high. So now next slide, 79. Simple data set. I've been using it. I borrowed it from a presentation made by Dr. Warren and Nussbaum at NARPM conference last year. This is a simple example. There is only one detection limit. And actually, this slide probably I have shown you last time. Now, the summary statistics for data sets for non-detect, doesn't show you anything except the minimum and the maximum. Only statistics based upon detected data are displayed in this table on page 79. Now let's move to next slide. I probably have shown you these graphs also, how ProUCL can generate QQ plot and box plot for data sets with non-detect. While generating QQ plot, you have three options to display non-detect. One is simply don't show them, or display non-detect at the values, reported values, or display them half of the detection limits. Next slide, 81. And I think we briefly went over the goodness of fit test for data sets with non-detect. So I have several options here. You just exclude the non-detect, or use your normal ROS method, or gamma ROS method, or log ROS method, replace the non-detect by half of the detection limit, and then perform your goodness of fit test on that data thus obtained. The last option, the GOX statistics shown on slide 81, you know, that just simply displays all the goodness of fit statistics so UCL can compute. Some users wanted to have all the statistics on one table instead of on graphical display, so that's why those statistics, that option is available, the GOX statistics. In this, on slide 81, in this we are excluding all the non-detects and we are trying to see the data follow gamma distribution. And you can see, yes, it does. You know, there is, you know, we are ignoring all the non-detects, so it's simply a simple gamma GOF test on detected data. Next slide. Didn't take me to the next slide now. Slide 82. Log ROS method. Same data set. Using log normal ROS method, we estimated, we kind of call and extrapolate those non-detects using log normal model. And then we back transform those and see whether the data are normally distributed or not. That's why log normal ROS method, and we are saying LROS data does not follow normal distribution. Extrapolated non-detects are shown in red. Next slide, 83, LROS in log scale. And because we are assuming a log normal model, we generated or extrapolated non-detects using log normal model. So all these non-detects are shown on the same straight line. Here on the vertical axis also, the values are displayed in log scale. And we are testing for log normal distribution. And conclusion is, yeah, the extrapolated data and the original data combined follow log normal distribution. Next slide. How do we test outliers? We have some limited options available in ProUCL. Outliers with NDs, either you exclude them or you replace them by DL over 2. All the non-detects are replaced by their respective DL over 2 values. And that's what we use in this example on page 84. So the Dixon test is suggesting that observation 9.29 is an outlier. As before we have been saying, the project team should decide what to do with this. Next slide, 85. After all the outliers have been identified, now we move on to computing various statistics, estimating various statistics such as mean, standard deviation, EPC terms, and so forth. So for data sets with NDs, we have these options available, normal, gamma, log normal, non-symmetric, or you can use all. In that case, everything that ProUCL can do will be displayed. So here, we are trying to compute 95% of our confidence limit for the mean. Next slide. Using non-symmetric method, that's what I don't know, you know, I'm just showing you the option here, but I think we computed all. Yeah. Next slide, slide 86. You know what we have there, UCL for TCE data, including the outlier. So how do you interpret these statistics? You know, I mean, for historical reasons, even though we don't recommend, by default, so UCL will compute various estimates using DLO2 substitution method. You know, if allowed, we probably should take it out, but it's there for historical reasons. So that's the first set there on the top. I'm on slide 86. So we have some statistics using DLO2 method, and then log normal ROS method. So the mean using, I mean, the mean and standard deviation based upon LROS method are displayed in that panel. And, you know, it's sometimes it's called robust ROS method or semi-parametric ROS method. You know, in this case, we showed earlier that you know, the original data, the detected data, plus extrapolated non-detect using LROS method followed normal distribution. So that takes you to HUCL, and that HUCL is 14.23, which is, of course, elevated in comparison with, you know, various other statistics. Now, if you just go directly to the KM method, here is the mean. KM, based upon the KM method, is 2. Standard deviation is 2.4. Standard error is 0.7. And various UCL based upon KM method are displayed on the right-hand side. KMT is based upon students' T. The critical value is coming from there. The BCA bootstrap, bias-corrected, accelerated bootstrap method, simple percentile bootstrap, and then very Chebyshev KM UCL there. So if, you know, we were using it, we probably will select KM BCA bootstrap method. There is still a little bit of fixing to do in terms of recommendations, because this all option, this all option is very complicated. You know, we test for all the distributions that so UCL can perform, and so it does that, and it shows the data appear gamma distributed. May want to try gamma UCLs. You know, I mean, I think in the next slide I will talk about gamma ROS statistics. I included that after making this presentation. Just note that K hat, the estimate of the shape parameter associated with gamma distribution, is 0.129. I'll be referring to this value in the next few slides. So K hat is small, 0.129. It's less than 0.5. See, whenever, I think I should talk about it next, on next slide. So, K hat is 0.129. Next slide. Slide 87. We have various statistics computing using gamma ROS method. See, the gamma ROS, both gamma and log normal distribution are for non-negative values. All the values should be greater than zero. Actually, I should say positive values. It cannot even be zero. So when you are using these ROS methods, normal ROS method for sure can result in negative extrapolated values. So that's, its uses should be avoided. And when gamma distribution is highly skewed, meaning when K estimate of scale shape parameter, which is K star, which is 0.129, is smaller than 0.5, the gamma ROS can result in negative values. And because we know gamma distribution cannot take negative values, so we have to replace them by some small positive value. And it depends what value you replace. You know, if you replace, so we, initial versions of ProUCL, we were replacing them by, I think, e to the minus 6. Or maybe e to the minus 12, because, you know, they are very small. So all values, all negative extrapolated values were replaced by very small, e to the minus 6 or something. And then we were playing with it, then we noted if you replace by something else, then the values change significantly. On the left table on page 87 are the results obtained by replacing negative extrapolated values by 0.0001, and on the right hand side, statistics are displayed by values replaced by e to the minus 6. So you can see the difference. The approximate UCL on the left side is 6.8. Adjusted UCL on the left side is 8.4, whereas on the right side it's 8.8 and 11.3. So the lesson we are learning here, these ROS methods, you know, when we have non-parametric methods like KM, we should probably avoid their use, you know, whether it's gamma ROS or log normal ROS or normal ROS. For academic purpose, you want to play with it and study it a little more. So whatever I know so far about these, you know, I recommend to use KM methods. Next slide, 88. Okay. So I need to give time for Nancy. So now we will be computing background features for data sets with non-detects. Same thing, except my data set will have non-detects. So here on slide that I showed you on slide 88. And now let's move to slide 89. Here are the various statistics obtained using log ROS method, maximum likelihood method, KM method. Maximum likelihood method assumes normality, log ROS, you know, you have to deal with extrapolated values, and then you can see again this UTL 9595 is 43.98 for log ROS method. So again, you know, this log normal distribution is resulting in unrealistically large estimates. And if you go to KM method, there is 95 UTL. With 95 coverage, it's 8.427. So if you have to use it, you know, that's the value. No, we will be using. Next slide. Okay, good. That's the end of my presentation, and I will give it to Felicia, who will introduce Nancy, and I really thank Nancy for agreeing to do this case study for us. Thank you very much. Over to Felicia.
Thank you, Anita. As Anita said, we're going to move straight into Nancy Jahoy's presentation. And she is from EPA Region 3 and is graciously going to help us with this presentation on the work that she's done on one of her sites. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Felicia, and thank you, Anita, for giving me this opportunity to present a case study today. We are on slide number 90. And today I'm going to be concluding the webinar with a ProUCL 4.1 case study on estimating background threshold values, BTBs, using an arsenic data set with non-detects from a very large federal facility. Moving on to slide number 91, The objective here is going to be to compute site-specific background level concentrations or not to seat values, which is really what BTVs are, in order to compare those values to site data to make remedial decisions. We're going to be looking at the background reference data set and graphically displaying the observations to determine if there are outline observations. And Anita mentioned to you more than several times here the importance of graphically displaying your data set to determine whether you have outline concentrations, observations, or multiple populations. So we'll be going through that again, performing outlier tests for those outline observations that we feel are outline. And then we're going to discuss as a team their disposition, whether or not we want to keep in as part of the background data set or whether we really think that there are contaminated areas of the site. Then we're going to establish the, once this background data set is established, then we're going to be performing a goodness of fit test to determine the data distribution to help us determine what background threshold value statistics to use, parametric or non-parametric. And for added insight, we're going to be graphically displaying the background threshold values with the on-site concentrations for the areas of concern. Moving on to slide number 92. Here we have the alternate background data set of about a size 48. The graph suggests that there are probably about 22.7. There's an outlier, which is extreme, and there's also another intermediate outlier, approximately three intermediate outliers between 12 and 13. And notice on the QQ plot of the arsenic data that this data set has many non-detect observations. Moving on to slide number 93. Assuming that you've met as a team and you've looked at the graphical display we just looked at, noting that there is at least one extreme outlier at 22.7 and three intermediate outliers at 12 to 13, taking this information, we perform the Rossner test to determine whether we have true outline concentrations. And the Rossner test was used because it can handle data sets greater than 25, which is what we have here. And also, we can look at what groups of outliers at the time, whereas the Gibson test would not be appropriate for this. For the Rossner test, the null hypothesis is rejected when the test value is greater than the critical value. As you notice here, when we tested for five outliers, noting that maybe nine might be a potential outlier, the test value was less than the critical value. 2.365 is less than 3.08. So therefore, we conclude that the null hypothesis cannot be rejected and there are not five outliers in the data set. We then go and test for four outline concentrations. And we know that the test value is greater than the critical value. 3.114 is greater than 3.09 for the potential outlier at 12. Since the test value is greater than the critical value, we accept the alternate hypothesis that there are outline concentrations and there are approximately four outliers in the data set. These four outliers were graphically displayed already, and they were 22.7, 13.2, 12.2, and 12. And they were significant at the 0.05 level of significance. Note here that if you tested for 1% significant level, that there's only one potential outlier at 22.7. That's the extreme one. So it is very important, as Anita mentioned several times here, that you supplement the outlier test with the graphical display and that you talk to the team about the outline concentrations to determine based on the conceptual site model and also historical information about the site whether the outline concentrations are part of background or not. Moving on to slide number 94. Here we have a QQ plot of the background arsenic data set without the four outliers. We made a decision as a team, and we decided, yep, we do not have four. Those are two outliers, and we're going to not use them. So here for the QQ plot, you note again that there are a number of non-detecting data sets, and also note that the graph does not display the linear pattern. Therefore, the background arsenic does not follow a normal distribution. Moving on to slide number 95. This is just a summary statistics of the background reference area and the area of concern data set. If you look at the percent non-detect, you note that the background data set has about up to 10 non-detects in the data set. Moving on to slide number 96. We then go on to determine the goodness of fit test in the distribution for this data set. We note, as previously noted, that the background data set has 10 non-detects, and it also has multiple detection limits. And for this data set, with this many non-detects, it's not very easy to perform distributional tests, and it probably isn't justifiable as well. So we just went on to a non-parametric test that Anita just finished discussing, the KM method. The KM method can handle data sets with non-detects and multiple detection limits. And we felt that this was the appropriate test to use to compute the background pressure values. Moving on to slide number 97. Here we have the estimates of the background pressure values using the KM method. On the left, we have the background pressure values estimates without the four outlying concentrations. And on the right, you have the background pressure value estimates without one outlier. Without four outliers, the BTB estimate using the KM method is 8.251. And the BTB estimate using the KM method is 10.55, assuming that there is just one outlier. Now, these numbers, there might be a very minor difference between the two numbers, whether you assume there are four outlying concentrations or one outlying concentration. But depending on your on-site data set, it may make a big difference between cleaning up or not. So therefore, we do stress that you look at the graphical display, and as a team, you make the decision to include four outliers or one outlier or whatever the case is for your data set. So this is a team approach. Moving on to slide number 98. The PLPs for the site wanted us to calculate a more robust background pressure value, suggesting that maybe we can use the area of concern data set. And we did just that. We expanded the background data set using the on-site AOC data. And since we already had a background data set of 48, they gave us an idea more or less of where background was. We used that background threshold value that was calculated that we just did at the cutoff point to determine how many of the observations were less than the BTB value and indeed were coming from the background population. And this established our expanded background data set. Moving on to slide 99, we just want to distinguish here that extracting background data set is different from expanding the background data set. Extraction occurs when you have only on-site data. No background data is available, and you wish to take your on-site data, all the areas of concern, and all that data, and determine where background is. So you take that data, and you plot it on a QQ plot, and with population partitioning methods, you can separate the background from the on-site concentrations. We did not do that at this site because we did have background data available. And typically when you have background data available already, you use those BTB values as your cutoff point. When you extract a data set, when you plot it, you look at the inflection point and at the elbow where you see that turn. Right around there is where you have a separation between background and on-site data. And later on we'll illustrate this for you. Moving on to slide 100. As indicated before, we used the background pressure value to expand our data set. And this was 8.25. The upper tolerance level at 95 or 95% coverage was 8.25 without the four outliers. And this resulted in a background expanded data set of about 639. The expanded background data set and the original background data set were plotted on former index plots and QQ plots. Using both the data set plotted without four outliers and the data set plotted without one outlier, in order to determine how many of the on-site observations were above the background threshold value. Moving on to slide 101. Both ProUCL and Scout that you've heard about a lot last time we met were software packages that were used to establish the expanded background data set. Scout, as you recall, has more advanced graphical capabilities and more robust statistical methods. There is an older version of it that can be downloaded from the EPA ESD website. The most updated version should be coming out shortly. Moving on to slide 102. Scout can generate graphical display, including index plots and QQ plots by groups, so you can actually have group labels on your observations. These graphs can also be formalized. Somebody was asking about where the lines came from for the box plot before in ProUCL. ProUCL, only the box plot is where you can do that, but the other graph is like the QQ plots, and there is no index plots. ProUCL does not currently have that capability. With Scout, you can do that. You can do horizontal lines and provide whatever statistics you want. If you want to show your management or your audience where the UCL is in relationship to your on-site observations, then you have a horizontal line showing where your UPL is, or your UTL, or your mean, whatever it is that you want to show. Scout, you can label observations by values as well, and by group IDs. And this provides a formal visual comparison of your background and your on-site data set. And this is one of the things I really liked about this was that you don't need a lot of statistical knowledge to read the graphic. So it's very easy to show to anyone who doesn't know a lot about statistics that here are the background pressure values, here's the horizontal line, and right above it are your on-site observations, which are above that and are in exceedance. Moving on to slide 103. This is the first example of a graph generated by Scout. It's a QQ plot using the original background data set without the four outline concentrations, plotted against the area of concern data set. The graph compares arsenic on site and the original background without the four outline concentrations. And the arrow points where the four outliers would be had we had them there. And you know from this graphic that the observations that are above background, the background threshold value, are noted by their values. And ProUCL can also do the same thing. You can also do get values on, that's one thing that you can't do in ProUCL is get the values. You can do the horizontal line where you see the maximum non-detect. So that you cannot get from the ProUCL. Moving on to slide 104. This is also a QQ plot using the expanded background data set without the four outliers. The graph again identifies the on-site observations that are statistically higher than background population. This graph was generated by ProUCL. And notice that there are no horizontal lines here. And there are no labels, no group IDs. But I do believe that you can put the values in there. Moving on to slide 105. This graph was generated by Scout. It's the same data set that you saw just previously in the last slide. It is a QQ plot using the expanded background data without the four outliers. But you can see here where the values are shown by their group IDs. The group labels, and you can see which of the areas of concern are above background, what those concentrations were, how far away from the background threshold value they were, and how they compare to other areas of concern at the site. So this gives the manager a lot of information about where the contaminated areas are and how much of the site, how much of that area of concern is contaminated. Moving on to slide 106. Now, this is what we call a former index plot. It's only available in Scout. Scout 1.0 doesn't have the capabilities yet to do the horizontal lines, but the newer one that will be coming out soon should have that capability. This was created using the newer one, the beta version. So this is the former index plot of the expanded background data without the one outlier against the areas of concern data sets. The graph again shows the background threshold values computed using background data without one outlier and also without four outliers. The AOCs that you see below there are the ones that are exhibiting the higher arsenic concentrations in background. Note here where the retained background outliers lie. Right about the upper tolerance level there. So it is important as a team that you determine whether the outline concentrations are part of background or whether or not they are actually part of the site. And also note from this slide where you have the group labels. So, again, making it easy for you to compare one AOC with the other AOC and also comparing the distance of the DTB value to the actual observation for that AOC. So, for example, at FA1 TNT, you have a concentration observation there of about 145.6 on the right here. And if you look on the left, the AOC 12 has concentration of about 95.6. So you can compare that with your background threshold values, which are between 8 or 10, depending on which one you chose. This one was graphed without one outlier, so it's 10.55. So you get a lot of information from looking at the visual for this graph here. The manager can decide now, I see that there are a lot of observations for SA1 TNT that are above background. We definitely need to do something there. And also see that the concentrations are not exceeded by a little, but they're exceeded by a pretty nice sizable amount, that there's really no uncertainty. This particular site, SA1 TNT, has a contaminated area, for example. Moving on to slide 107. This is a former index plot, again, of the expanded background data set without four outliers. And again, it shows observations about the BTB that may not belong to the background. And here we illustrate how the mean concentrations without one outlier and without four outliers are below the largest non-detect. So you can show information about what's happening with your data set. So not just what's happening between background threshold values and your observations on site, but what has actually happened with the data set. You know that there may have been something that happened to create all these non-detects. And also note here that you no longer see the retained outliers. They're no longer above the upper tolerance level there. Moving on to slide 108. This graph was computed using Scout. And it illustrates the extraction background data set. And you see here where the extraction point is around 15, and the average cutoff point is between 9 and 13. That represents the cutoff between your background data set, which consists of all the data set for this particular example, including the original background and all the on-site data set, just for illustration purposes. Ordinarily, we would not do it like that, but just for illustration purposes, we assumed that all of it was on-site data. So at the inflection point there, at that ALBA point, represents the separation between background and on-site data. So somebody last week was asking about data blending, I think regarding lead. So this might be an approach that you might be able to take, depending on what your situation is. Moving on to slide 109. I started previously, the background outlier. Well, if you go back to slide 108, it's interesting to note here that your background outliers, 22.7, is right where we assume that the data is contaminated, right above the inflection point. So something to consider when you're considering these outlier concentrations, how important it is to discuss this as a team. So we note here that 22.7, in slide 109 we are now, represent an impacted location. At the ALBA of the QQ plot seems to be around 9 to 13. The inflection point is around 15. That represents the cutoff between your oceanic and background and your on-site locations. So this information is then taken, noted, and anything, any arsenic less, any area of a concern with arsenic less than 9 to 13 may be considered as representing site-specific background. We take that data and we calculate our BTB values. And we go through the process to determine what the distribution is of that data set and whether you should use a parametric versus a non-parametric BTB, et cetera. Moving on to slide 110. To summarize here, it is very important to collect an appropriate amount of background data to determine any background statistics, any statistics really. Make sure that the outliers have been properly noted and that the team has decided upon whether or not they want to keep that as part of background or determine that it would actually represent impacted location. You do this by visualizing the data on QQ plots. QQ plots is where you can see the extremeness in outline concentrations and whether you have multiple populations. Outlier tests are also performed to determine whether the outline concentrations are true outliers. Moving on to slide 111. But noting here that statistics are not the only methods of eliminating outliers. You also need to base your decision on the conceptual site model, what your exposure is, historical information. In this particular case, the arsenic at this site was also contributed by pesticide use. So the infestogenic sources of arsenic are site-related and non-site-related. So we actually had to separate site-related, non-site-related infestogenic sources in addition to the natural sources of arsenic. Then you perform your goodness of fit test to determine your data distribution. Based on that data distribution, you determine what test to use for your background pressure value, parametric or non-parametric. And you do graphical comparison, as I just showed you, to determine whether you need to remediate your site or not. Moving on to slide 112, one thing that we consider for this large federal facility is using the different estimates of the background pressure values and looking at uncertainty. For a large sort of facility like this where you potentially have to clean a lot of the areas of concern, it probably is a good idea to look at this uncertainty. We noted here three different values that can be used to do this. We collected the data for the background locations, and we calculated a background threshold value based on that original data set. we expanded the background data set using the original background data, and we extracted the background data set. Now, whether or not background extraction of data is appropriate for your site is something that the team should discuss. Between those three estimates, and there are probably more estimates that you can consider, you might be able to develop some kind of either semi-qualitative or even quantitative value of uncertainty around the background threshold value that the managers can use to make a more cost-effective decision. Moving on to slide 113. One thing I need to caution is that your ProUCL is a nice program to use. There's statistics. You can just input data in. You come out with a statistic, and it's great, and you have an answer. You basically don't have to do much at all. But it's very important to caution that you need to know the background behind the statistics, and you need to use the appropriate statistics for your situation. And this is where I recommend that you consult a statistician to get clarification on which is the best approach for your site. To establish your background data set, UCLs, or any kind of statistics that you're going to be using, but especially for background threshold values. I'll give it back to Felicia now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Oh, thank you very much, Nancy. We're going to go now, everybody, just a break for a few minutes, but we're also going to have a question and answer session, and then we'll finish up in about 15 minutes. If we don't get to any of the questions, or get to all the questions, certainly everything that's been typed in will be sent to us, and we'll try to respond back to them. As I said earlier, we do respond to most questions that people send to us about ProUCL anyway, so certainly you can get on the web and get my email address that's on the ProUCL website and send those to me. So I'm going to turn it back over to Jean, and I assume we're going to start with phone east to west again.
Yep, we're going to start again with telephone lines for questions, and we'll continue to collect those comments and questions that have been submitted electronically, and we'll address the ones that we can with the time that we do have left. So we're going to go ahead and go back to the way we had things earlier. We're going to start with the East Coast time zone. And for anyone on the telephone lines who would like to ask a question out loud, you can certainly do so now, again, if you're in the East Coast time zone, by hitting #6 to take yourself off of mute. Remember, I've globally muted all lines. So you'll need to hit #6, and then you can identify yourself and go ahead and ask your question or comment out loud. Okay, we have a quiet group this time, but that's okay. I have no problem with that. Let's go ahead over to the central time zone. If you're in the central time zone and you have a question, feel free to hit #6, identify yourself, and ask your question. Okay, let's move over to the mountain time zone. Again, #6, identify yourself, and ask your question. And we'll go to Pacific time zone, #6, identify yourself and ask your question. All right, one last call on the phone lines. If you don't know what time zone you're in, or if you are not in any of the time zones above, please hit #6 and feel free to ask your question out loud. Okay, that's all right. We don't mind a quiet phone line audience. We do have a number of people that are typing up questions electronically. If you do, though, on the phone lines come up with something as we're moving through, don't worry. We'll take a second to switch back and try to close out with additional phone questions before we formally end things today. So I'm going to start with some questions that were asked online. And the first one I'm going to start with is coming in from the US EPA in Denver, Colorado. And they ask, can ProUCL examine spatial distribution of sample points?
ProUCL does not have any spatial methods, spatial statistics. You know, it doesn't even have post plots. So, no, not yet.
Okay. The next question is coming in from, looks like AECOM in Greenville, South Carolina. And they say, when detection limits are discussed when performing tests with non-detected concentrations, are you referring to method detection limits or the higher reporting limits? Laboratories typically report non-detected concentrations as less than the reporting limit, for example, less than 50, while the method detection limit may be 10. Do we use 10 or 50 for our computations?
That's a good question, and I probably am not the right person to answer it. Being a statistician, I just take the data, data set as it comes to me, and whatever they report, the data, the people who are preparing the data sets or the chemists behind, they, whatever they report, it's the less than value or the detection limit itself, sometimes the data, in the data set I will say it's less than 50, and sometimes I will just see it's 50 and then there will be a qualifier associated with it, it's you. So whatever the report, I don't go there, to determine whether it's the method detection limit or the non-detect reported, observed by the lab or whatever. I'm just dealing with the data set, so I'm not there.
Anita, I can
probably answer your question.
I can probably respond a little bit to that. We prefer in region 3 to use a sample quantitation limit because it takes into consideration matrix effects. And we have been using that for a while now as opposed to the method detection limit.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from Environ Corporation in Portland, Maine, and they ask what time formats are available in ProUCL. Must the time data be numeric, or is there a date format available?
For simplicity, we just wanted it numeric for now. If there's a demand, I could handle something like January, February, March later, but it involves more coding, and for now, 1, 2, 3, 4 through 12 seemed like the easiest way to get more bang for the buck. So that's how we wrote the time frames. I'm sorry.
Sure, no problem. This next question is coming in from EA Engineering Science and Technology in Sparks, Maryland. And I can answer this one. They're asking if the PowerPoint presentation from ProUCL, the first webinar, is still available to assist an individual with training that's new to ProUCL. And the answer to that is yes. In fact, what I will do is email you a link to where you can access the slides. And if you're interested, the recording should be available from the first session in this series in just a few days. If you go to cruin.org and visit our training calendar, there are links to sign up for our free podcast. So as soon as our trainings are available, you can actually get a link and you can download it and replay it. So again, I'll remind everybody when we close out how you can access not only today's slide, but as well as the slides from the previous session. This next question is coming in from SCVWD in San Jose, California. And they ask, for the Mann-Kendall trend test that was performed by ProUCL, is the trend test based on a two-sided p-value or a one-sided p-value? Is there an option to use either? And if it only uses one-sided p-value, should we use a different message, such as the Thiel send to be thorough?
The way the p-values are computed, they are one-sided. They are based upon the values of, if S, the test statistic, is positive, then the p-value is computed assuming that there could be significant upward trend. And if p-value, downward p-value is computed when, associated with the negative S. So those p-values are for one-sided trends. And the Thiel test, there is a one-sided test also for Thiel. I think, you know, we do have that option. We provide you with the lower limit LCL for tile test. You know, both tests can be used to detect upward trends or downward trends. And for tile test, we have, you know, the trend is determined based upon the confidence interval, the significance. And so I think in brief, your answer, you know, answer to your question will be, yeah, those are one-sided p-values.
If there's some coding that is special, I could look into it. On occasion, I went from the documents and the literature I had and used just the one that I had it, which was one-sided.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is also related to that, coming in from Dillon Consulting in Vancouver, Washington. They're asking if you could please discuss the main differences between the Mann-Kendall and the Thiel or Tile SEN methods and the preference of use for each of these methods. Could you use them for any situation?
Yeah, you can use them for any situation. You know, I mean, you know, they are two different tests. And so as such, you know, I do not have a preference of using one test over the other. Trend test has a trend line. I mean, the tile test has a trend line, and you can generate a confidence interval around that trend line. And Mann-Kendall test has a simple statistic. You know, the both tests are equally good. You know, typically the both tests should yield to the same conclusion. So,
okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. The next question comes in from SAIC in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And this is actually, I think, a clarifying comment that they're making. They say, in reference to slide number 93, remember that Rosner's test assumes that data are normally distributed. The data with potential outliers are not normally distributed, so the assumptions of the outlier test are not met.
Yeah, that is actually a very good question, and we had this question last week also. These tests, Rosner test or Dixon test, they do assume normality, but in essence, these outlier tests should not assume, you know, if you have an outlier, you know, outlier is going to destroy your normality. You know, that is a fact. And so, you know, the assumption that the underlying distribution is normal cannot be satisfied with the data set consisting of outliers. You know, I mean, unless it's a very mild outlier on the borderline of the tail of the normal distribution. So I do recommend to use robust methods. You know, there are many, many robust methods which do not assume normality, and they are actually resistant to outliers, and they work much better. And we do not have one. Fortunately, we do not have those tests in ProUCL, but there are many, many such methods in Scout and also in other commercial software packages like SAS, and, you know, I'm aware of SAS. And the R has, you know, this robust group, you know, statistician dealing with robust methods. They have developed an outlier module dealing with robust methods. So, you know, I don't know, maybe it's time to rethink about this normality assumption for Rosner and Dixon test. They do assume it, and it can never be justified. People tend to use log normal distribution to make sure that it's normally distributed and then accommodate outliers. So, you know, those tests were developed, you know, several years ago. Most of the robust statistical methods, they came into existence in 80s and 90s and till present. So, you know, I will suggest to you know, the person who is asking to consult robust methods or maybe rethink about this normality assumption. How valid is this assumption?
Okay, great. Let's see. Do we want to take a minute or two and see if anybody on the phone lines has any questions? Because we still have some that were submitted online, but we are approaching the conclusion or the suggested end time for today's session. So let's see if we can get anybody on the phone lines who may have a question. Again, if you're on the phone lines, it doesn't matter what time zone, you can simply hit #6, identify yourself, and ask your question or make a comment out loud. Okay, well then with that, since I don't hear anybody on the phone lines, I'm going to continue to read off the electronic questions. And this next one is coming in, again, also from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And they say that on flag 97, is the KM 95% UTL with 95% coverage computed with a parametric K value in order to achieve the 95% coverage? Otherwise, if it is non-parametric, there is not enough data to achieve 95% coverage since N is less than 59.
That non-parametric method is probably dealing based upon order statistics. You know, when you compute these UTLs and UPLs based upon order statistics, which is also a non-parametric method. The coverage provided by 95 UTL may not be 95, you know, that remains to be evaluated. But people tend to use it, you know, for sample sizes as small as 10. KM, you know, we also have KM.
Anita, if you're still on the phone lines, it sounds like we've had your line cut off. I don't know if you're still there, if you could double check to see maybe if you've accidentally muted your line.
Can I hop in here?
Until Anita hops on, certainly. Go ahead.
Anita, are you back?
A general comment on some of these, especially KM hasn't been the 59 is a rule of thumb that was thrown out a long time ago, and it's a really great one. I'm a programmer, not a statistician, and I would defer if Dr. Singh comes back on, I'll shut up. But the same person, you know, somebody asked us about Wilson-Hilfrey and Hawkins-Wixley, and then later somebody asked us about Mann-Kendall and Thale-Sann, and now you're another question. All of these require long-term simulations where I generate several million random gamma distributions in the Wilson-Hilferty Hawkins-Wixley case, and I see which one works better in prediction, and the same with the Mann-Kendall Thale-Sann, and it would be the same thing. How accurate are they, and where is that number? Is it 59? Is it 40? Is it 30 for the KM? UTL, UPL, whatever prediction, and we don't really know until we simulate it, and it takes time and effort, and we haven't got it. I don't have an answer.
I have Anita on my cell phone. Did it get cut off? So maybe, can we check that, Jean?
Sure. If you can conference Anita in, go right ahead.
Anita, can you hear us?
I can hear you. I can't hear Anita.
Okay, just a minute. Anita?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear Anita now? Go ahead, Anita.
Barely. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, just sample size of 59. You know, that is, you know, I mean, that's correct. That's used, you know, it's required when you are using the UTL of, you know, non-parametric UTL based upon order statistics. So, you know, that's a good question. Maybe we should look into it. If you think the sample size here, 48, you know, UTL is, You know, that's the best I can answer. You know, I mean, we have not performed the simulation studies to see if the UTL based upon KMF that can really, you know, does really provide 95% coverage or not.
Okay, great. Thank you. Seeing as how we do have a not-so-great connection with Dr. Singh and we are approaching our final or conclusion time, I do have all of the electronic questions that have been submitted that we haven't asked captured, and I will be able to share those with our presenters. Felicia, would you be okay if we go ahead and move ahead with closing things out for today?
Yes, especially, since we've lost Anita. let's move on and close it out. And if anybody on the phones has thought of something, of course, they can always email us, and we'll respond back to them. So,
okay, great. So are there any other closing statements that you want to make to everyone?
Just that I appreciate the interest, and certainly all the questions have been very useful to us, because, like I said, we're always looking at pro-UCL and trying to make it as relevant as possible and to respond to people and getting questions on this so people can, the people who weren't able to make it can go back and listen and hopefully get something out of the two courses that we've had. Has been very useful for us here at EPA and hopefully for you as well. And so thanks to everybody who came. I want to thank Dr. Singh and Anita and for Dr. Singh and Nancy, thank you. Sorry, Nancy. For doing the presentation today. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Jean.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. I'm going to ask everyone, if you can, to move on to the final slide in your presentation materials today, which is slide number 114. On slide number 114, you'll find the two links that I mentioned earlier when we started things today. The first one is a link to additional resources. If you don't have the electronic version of the slides open, you can certainly go back to the seminar homepage, and you'll see those very same links on the left side as well as at the bottom of the seminar homepage. On the additional resources page, not only will you find a copy of today's PowerPoint presentation, but you'll also find a link to the Pro-UCL homepage, which does have Felicia Barnett's contact information. So I certainly encourage you to go to the Pro-UCL homepage to not only download the software, look at other resources and information there, but also feel free to contact Felicia with follow-up questions later on. The other link that you'll find on slide number 114 is our short feedback form. It takes just a few seconds to fill out. It's just a couple of questions. And if you thought that today's session was useful or informative, we would ask that you fill that form out to let us know. It's your feedback that encourages us to make sure that we can continue to deliver these types of free technical training online. For those of you who are looking for confirmation of your participation today for record keeping or perhaps credit, while we don't offer CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN, some people have luck if they fill out the form and check the box to have a confirmation email sent to them for their records. We'll get credit if they keep the confirmation email as well as a copy of the presentation materials. Some accrediting institutions will give them credit for participating today. If you shared the line with multiple people, each individual person will have a chance to fill out that feedback form. Once you submit it, there's a link to have someone else fill out the form on the same computer. Alternatively, again, you can go to the seminar homepage, and at the bottom of that homepage, you'll see links to the feedback form, and that stuff will stay active for several days. So if you can't do it now, you can certainly come back to it in a few days. This is a reminder, if you were looking to download the previous session, so webinar part one, which is Pro-UCL Basics, which took place last week, we have those slides available from the Pro-UCL homepage for that particular event. Again, it was recorded, and we expect to have that archive up in just a few days. So if you visit cluin.org/training, you'll see links to our archive seminars page. And although Pro-UCL Part 1 isn't there yet, it will be in a few days. So you can continue to check that page. Alternatively, you can sign up for our free podcast in iTunes. And as soon as those archive sessions are available, you'll get a notice and be able to download them or replay them as soon as they're available. For today's session, though, for those of you who did register and participate today, you will automatically get an email with the link and information to download and replay this session Part 2 as soon as it's available. Again, it usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to have the archives available. As for the questions that we weren't able to address, if you typed them up electronically and you didn't hear them read out loud, don't worry. We have a queue captured up, and I will share all of those questions, which does include contact information for the people who submitted them, to all of our presenters so that they'll be able to work with you and follow up afterwards. Again, if you're on the phone lines and you didn't have a chance to ask a question, You can certainly refer to the Pro-UCL homepage to look up Felicia Barnett's information. You'll also find contact information for our other instructors as well as myself on the seminar homepage that you used when you registered for today's session. And if you can get in touch with me, I'll make sure to get it off to Felicia or to the other people involved today. So that is the formal end of the closing statements that I have for everyone. I again also want to extend my thanks to our organizers from the EPA's ORD Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center, who sponsored today's session. I want to thank all of our presenters who joined us, and I want to thank the over 375 people we had on various lines from all around the world who joined us for today's Internet seminar. I hope that you found today's session a useful expenditure of your time, and that we will hear from you or see you on a future Clue and Internet seminar. This is the formal conclusion of today's session. Thank you all, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.